We present Ian Carmichael as Lord Peter Wimsey in Busman's Honeymoon by Dorothy L. Sayers, adapted for radio by Alistair Beaton. With Sarah Bedell as Lady Peter Wimsey and Peter Jones as Bunter. Episode 4, Not Why, But How.
There is not a senior police officer in the whole of Britain who would care to face the dilemma in which Superintendent Kirk now found himself. His own local constable had suddenly become a prime suspect in the murder of William Noakes, the previous owner of the house which Lord Peter and his wife had just purchased. Having withheld information from his superior officer, Constable Sellon was then found to be lying about his movements on the night of the murder. To compound the gravity of the situation, it was now clear that Sellon had the strongest of motives for the removal of William Noakes from this earth, for Noakes had been remorselessly blackmailing him for almost 2 years. It gave Lord Peter little satisfaction to think that he, personally, had been responsible for detecting that Sellon had been lying. To send a young man to the executioner's rope was not an ambition which he cherished. While he sympathized with Superintendent Kirk's anxious attempts to clear Sellon's name, both he and Harriet knew that the evidence far outweighed their sympathies.
And what did the superintendent want last night, Bunter?
He wished to ascertain, my lady, whether the hanging cactus in the sitting room could have been removed from its containing pot during the events of last week.
I thought he realized that it couldn't. The marks of the brass polish should have told him that with half an eye. No need to get the stepladder and bump around at midnight like a bumblebee in a bottle.
Quite so, my lord. But I thought it better not to intervene, and your lordship wished him to have every facility.
Oh, quite. His brain works like the mills of God, but he has some other divine qualities. I know him to be magnanimous and suspect him of being merciful. He's trying hard to exonerate Constable Sellon. Well, that's natural enough.
Yes, my lord. Shall I request Mrs. Ruddle to remove the breakfast things, my lord?
Oh, I don't think Mrs. Ruddle would find it quite proper to see me in my dressing gown, do you, Bunter? Let her wait for a little.
Very good, my lord.
What do you think about Sellon yourself, Peter?
I don't know what to think. The fact is, we've got dashed little material for thinking with. Probably too early for thinking, anyway.
Sellon doesn't look like a murderer.
They very often don't, you know. He didn't look like the sort of man who would tell a thundering great lie, either. The fact remains that he could not have seen the clock from the window with that damn great cactus hanging in the way.
I suppose he didn't notice till after he'd said that about seeing the clock that it implied his having been inside the house.
No, you've got to be a very sharp-witted person to see ahead when you're telling half-truths. A story that's a lie from beginning to end will be consistent. But the thing that is bothering me is how did Joe Sellon get into the house?
Noakes must have let him in.
Just so. Here is an elderly man locked up alone in a house. Up comes a young man whom he's been blackmailing. And this young man, big and strong and in a murderous rage, quarrels with him, using strong language and possibly threats. The old man tells him to be off and bangs the window shut. The young man goes on knocking at the doors and trying to get in. The old man has nothing to gain by admitting him, yet he does it, and obligingly turns his back on him on purpose that the angry young man may attack him with a blunt instrument. It's possible, but as Aristotle might say, it is an improbable possible.
Suppose Sellon said he had got the money after all, and Noakes let him in.
If Sellon had the money, Noakes could have told him to hand it in through the window.
Well, suppose he did hand it in, or said he was going to. Then, when Noakes opened the window, Sellon could have climbed in himself. Or could he? Those mullions are pretty narrow.
You could have no idea how refreshing it is to talk to somebody who has a grasp of method.
Ah!
The police are excellent fellows, but the only principle of detection they have really grasped is that wretched phrase, qui bono. They will hair off after motive, which is a matter for psychologists. Motive by itself will never make a case. You've got to show how the thing was done, and then, if you like, bring in motive to back up your proof. If a thing could only have been done one way, and if only one person could have done it that way, then you've got your criminal, motive or no motive. There is how, when, where, why, and who. And when you have got how, you've got who. Thus spake Zarathustra.
I shall throw something at you in a minute. I say, do you think something might have been thrown at Noakes? Through the window? Suppose Selen started to climb in and Noakes got alarmed and made for the door. And then Selen might snatch up something.
What?
That's true. Oh, I know. That paperweight on the sill. He could have snatched that up and thrown it at Noakes's retreating back. And then he'd only have to finish scrambling in, pick up the paperweight, put it back, and go out through the window again.
Really?
Of course not. The window was locked from the inside.
Yeah.
No. He'd shut and lock the window. He'd get Noakes's keys from his pocket, open the front door, put back the keys, and then go out, leaving the door unlocked. And when Noakes came to, he obligingly locked it behind him. We've got to allow for that possibility, whoever did the murder.
That is really brilliant, Harriet. It's very difficult to find a flaw in it.
I say, Peter, all this is a bit grim.
It's only a theory, after all. We haven't proved a word of it. That is the worst of you mystery mongers. Anything's a solution as long as it holds together. Well, let's make a theory about somebody else. Whom should we have? How about Mrs. Ruddle? She's a tough old lady and not an altogether sympathetic character.
Why on earth should Mrs. Ruddle...
Look, never mind why. Why never gets you anywhere. Mrs. Ruddle came to borrow a drop of paraffin. Noakes was sniffing round and heard her. He invited her to step in and explain herself.
Yes.
He said that he'd often had doubts of her honesty. She said he owed her a week's money. High words passed. He made for her. She snatched up the poker. He ran away and she threw the poker at him and caught him on the back of the head. Now that is why enough when people lose their tempers. Unless you prefer to believe that Noakes made improper advances to Mrs. Ruddle and she dotted him one accordingly.
Idiot.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't fancy Mrs. Ruddle myself, but then my standards are high.
Let's hear the case against Crutchley and the vicar.
Well, they're a bit more difficult because of the alibi. Unless one of them was in league with Mrs. Ruddle, we've got to explain why Noakes didn't have the wireless on as usual for the 9:30 news that night. Take Crutchley first. He deposited the vicar at Pagford before 11.
Hmm.
Very early the next morning is Crutchley's time, I fancy, taking out a taxi for a non-existent customer or something of that kind. He must somehow have stolen a key or had one cut, though.
Suppose Crutchley came to rob the house and was rummaging in a bureau or something, in that kitchen where the will was found, and Noakes heard him and came downstairs.
Stopping to put on his collar and tie and carefully taking all his precious banknotes with him?
Of course not, in his night things. He interrupts Crutchley, who goes for him. He runs away. Crutchley hits him, thinks he's dead, gets the wind up and runs off, locking the door after him from outside. Then Noakes comes to, wonders what he's doing down there, goes back to his room, dresses, feels queer, goes towards the back door, meaning to fetch Mrs. Ruddle, and falls down the cellar steps.
Excellent. Who made the bed?
Oh, bother. Yes, and we haven't explained about the wireless. Oh, this is very discouraging.
Ain't it just there? Which now leaves the way open for a murderous attack by the vicar between 10:30 and 11 that evening.
But why should the... Sorry, I keep asking why. All the same, I do think it looks neater to have a comprehensive motive. Murder for the fun of it breaks all the rules of detective fiction.
All right, then. Mr. Goodacre shall have a motive. I'll think of one presently. He walks over from the vicarage at about 10:35 and knocks at the door. Noakes lets him in. There's no reason why he shouldn't let in the vicar, who has always appeared mild and friendly. But the vicar, underneath his professional austerity, conceals one of those dreadful repressions so common among clergymen, as depicted by our realistic novelists. So, of course, there's Noakes. The vicar, under cover of a purity campaign, accuses Noakes of corrupting the village maiden, whom he subconsciously wants for himself.
Of course! How silly of me not to have thought of it. Nothing could be more obvious. They have one of those squalid, senile rows, and the vicar ends up with a brainstorm and imagines he's the hammer of God, like the parson in Chesterton's story. He lays Noakes out with a poker and departs. Noakes recovers his senses, and we go on from there. And that accounts beautifully for the money's having been left on the body. Mr. Goodacre wouldn't want it.
Exactly. And the reason why the vicar is so pleasant and innocent about it all now is that the brainstorm has passed and he's forgotten the whole thing.
Dissociated personality. I think that's our best effort yet. We only need now to put a name to the village maiden.
Well, it needn't even be that. I mean, the vicar may have had a morbid fancy for something else. A passion a la Plato for an aspidistra. or a strange covetous longing for a cactus. Believe me or believe me not, the vicar came prowling round for no good, and when old Noakes flung himself on his knees crying, "Take my life, but spare the honour of my cactus," he upped with the aspidistra pot. How about this?
Oh, dear. It's all very well, Peter. But the poor old thing was really killed.
My heart, I know it. But until we find out how, one theory is as fanciful as another. We've got to laugh or break our hearts in this damnable world.
Well, it's no good. Never, never, never shall we do anything like other people. We shall always laugh when we ought to cry, and love when we ought to work, and make ourselves a scandal and a hissing. And now you'd better finish dressing and face the situation. Oh, look. There are two men coming up the path, one of them with a camera.
Oh, hell. It's Solcombe Hardy. It would be.
I'll go and entertain them.
Not alone, Harriet. Not alone. Now make it snappy, Sally, because the inquest's at 11 and I can't turn up in a dressing gown. What are you after? Romance in high life or mysterious death in honeymoon house?
Both. I suppose I'd better begin by offering mingled congratulations and condolences.
Thank you.
Do we mention that you are both in a state of collapse? Or is the message to the great British public that you are marvellously happy in spite of this untoward occurrence?
Be original, Sally. Say we're fighting like cat and dog and only relieved from irritable boredom by the prospect of a little detective occupation.
Come on, Whimsy. Look at it from my point of view. It's a story of the century. Famous amateur sleuth weds mystery writer, finds corpse on bridal night. Can I say you've got a theory of the crime?
Yes.
Fine.
My theory is that you put the corpse there yourself, Sally, to make a good headline.
I only wish I'd thought of it. Nothing else.
The fact is, he's completely baffled.
As baffled as a bathroom geezer. My wife's baffled, too. It's the only point on which we are at one. When we are tired of heaving crockery about, we sit and sneer at one another's bafflement. The police are baffled, too. Or else they confidently expect to make an arrest, one or the other. You can take your choice.
Well, it's a devil of a nuisance for you. And I'm a nuisance, too. But I can't help myself. Do you mind if we take a few photographs?
Oh.
Quaint Tudor farmhouse, all that? My photographer's outside.
Well, be quick, Sally, but for God's sake, use a little tact. No hanging about the back door snooping and asking questions of all and sundry.
All right, Sid. Let's have a few snaps of the house.
Done that already, Mr. Hardy.
Well, get a few more, lad. Have we neared the house from the garden?
Oh, well, no. I thought I had enough already, Mr. Hardy.
Oh, dear, you'll never make a press photographer if you don't show a little initiative. Well, get on with it, lad.
Yes, Mr. Hardy.
Mr. Hardy! Mr. Hardy, I wanted to have a word with you before you go.
But of course, Miss Vane. Oh, I'm sorry, Lady Peter. And if you permit me to ask just a couple more questions.
Mr. Hardy, listen. I know one's absolutely helpless. One has to put up with what newspapers choose to say. I've reason to know it. But if you put in anything sickening about Peter and me, you know what I mean, any of the sort of things that make one writhe and wish one was dead, it'll be pretty rotten for us and pretty rotten for you. Peter isn't exactly a rhinoceros, you know.
My dear Lady Peter, I shall be the soul of discretion. By the way, I forgot to ask. Do you intend to go on writing now that you're married?
Yes, of course.
Under the same name?
Naturally.
Can I say that?
Oh, yes, you could say that. You can say anything, except all that awful matrimonial tripe about said he with a laughing glance at his brand new wife and the rest of the romantic bilge water. I mean, it's all quite trying enough. Do leave us a little human dignity if you possibly can. Peter's been very decent to you. Don't make his life a burden to him.
Honestly, I'll try not. But editors are editors.
Editors are ghouls and cannibals.
They are, but I'll really do my best. Now, about this writing story, can you give me anything exclusive on that? Your husband's eager, you should continue your professional career, that kind of thing. You look forward to getting hints from his experience for use in your detective novels.
Oh, damn, must you have the personal angle on everything? Well, I'm certainly going on writing, and Peter certainly doesn't object. In fact, I think he entirely approves. But don't make him say it with a proud and tender look or anything sick-making, will you?
Of course not. You writing anything now?
No, I've only just finished a book. But I've got a new one in my head.
Good. What's it about?
It's about the murder of a journalist, and the title is Curiosity Killed the Cat.
Ah, fine.
I knew this place as a child. A dear old couple lived here who used to ask me in and give me seedy cake and strawberries. That's very pretty and human, and they're dead, so it can't hurt them.
Splendid.
And all the ugly furniture and the asbestos were put in the house by Noakes, so don't blame us for them. And he was a grasping sort of man who sold the Tudor chimney pots to make sundials. And that is somebody's ginger cat. He's adopted us. He sits on Peter's shoulder at breakfast. Everybody likes an animal story. You can have the ginger cat. Goodbye, Mr. Hardy.
Yes, goodbye.
But thank heavens the inquest's over.
Yes. As if that wasn't bad enough, we have to run the gauntlet of 24 reporters and cameramen when we emerge.
Old Salcombe Hardy is far from being the worst specimen of the species. Still, it proved to be relatively painless. I thought the coroner's adjournment decision was the right one in the circumstances.
Poor Selland didn't come out of it very well, though, did he?
Well, I think it was better than it came out in the open the way it did. Better than 1,000 different stories circulating round the village. Anyway, it's not general knowledge that Selland withheld information from Kirk.
That's true. I say, Peter.
Hmm?
Couldn't we just be selfish and naughty this afternoon?
Yes, how?
Go off somewhere by ourselves?
By God, we will. Is that really your notion of happiness?
To that depth have I fallen, I admit it. Don't dance on a woman when she's down.
Just how naughty and selfish may I be? May I drive fast? I mean really fast?
Yes, really fast, if you feel like that.
Definitely too good to live.
I should say definitely too good to die. But really fast means the main road.
So it does. We'll do the main road really fast and get rid of it.
Here's them things you asked me to polish, Mr. Bunter. And shall I put the peas on now, Mr. Bunter?
I will see to the peas, Mrs. Ruddle, at the proper time. His lordship is very particular about peas.
This year toasting forks come up lovely, ain't it?
Thank you, yes, very nice indeed.
Funny the way gentry is about them old bits of things. Curios. Oof, rubbish, if you ask me.
This is a very old piece, Mrs. Ruddle.
Well, reckon them as shoved it up the chimney knew what they were doing. Give me a nice gas oven any day.
People have been found dead in gas ovens before now, Mrs. Ruddle.
Lord now, Mr. Bunter, don't you talk like that. Ain't we had enough corpses about the house already? How that pair can go on living here, I don't know.
Speaking for his lordship and myself, we are accustomed to corpses.
Where he's happy, she's happy. And it's easy to see she worships the ground he treads on.
That is a very proper sentiment in a young married woman.
Happy days. Oh, but it's early days yet, Mr. Bunter. A man's a man when all's said and done. Mr. Ruddle, now. He used to knock me about something shocking when he'd had a drop, though a good husband and bringing the money home regular.
I beg you will not institute these comparisons, Mrs. Ruddle. I have served his lordship 20 years, and a sweeter-tempered gentleman you could not wish to find.
There now! If that ain't love's young dream a-coming up the path.
To whom might you be referring, Mrs. Ruddle?
Why, that Frank Crutchley, to be sure.
Oh, Crutchley. Is he your choice for a second?
Oh, go along with you, Mr. Bunter. Me? Oh, no fear. No, Aggie Twitterton runs after him like an old cat with one kitten.
Indeed?
At her age, mutton dressed as lamb makes me fair sick. If she knowed what I'd know...
Afternoon. Any special orders? I ran over thinking there might be. Mr. Hancock don't want me for an hour or two.
His lordship gave instructions that the car was to be cleaned, but now it's out again.
Ah, well, they've got a nice day for it. Well, they didn't get much forwarder at the inquest, seems to me.
Nudging it up. That's what they was, trying to make out there was nothing between Joe Selland and him. I wonder they let that young fella go about at large. He might all be murdered in our beds.
I think you'd better be careful in your accusations.
That's right. You go imagining things, you'll land yourself in Queer Street one of these days.
Well, I don't bear no particular grudge against Mr. Noakes. Not like some I could name with their £40s.
God almighty, what a tongue you got, you mangy old Paul Parrot.
Don't you talk to me like that, Frank Crutchley. And what are you hanging about in the kitchen for anyhows? Waiting for kisses in the gloaming?
What are you getting at?
Look out there and you'll see. Aggie Twitterton, coming down the hill on her bicycle.
God, it's her all right, damn it.
What it is to be the answer to a maiden's prayer.
Now, see here, Polly's my girl, you know that. There ain't nothing between me and Aggie Twitterton.
Not between you and her, but there might be between her and you. And now, if you'll excuse me, there's some of us has work to do.
I have to admit, Peter, that this speed is more to my liking.
Yes, I can see that. I don't happen to be afraid of speed. That's why I like to show off. But I give you my word, I won't do it again. Well, not this trip, anyway.
Oh, Peter, look at that ruined church. Let's stop and take a look.
An excellent idea. Good heavens, Harriet. Look at that over there.
What?
The sundial. May I lose my last dollar if it ain't one of our chimney pots?
Oh, it can't be, can it?
Well, it can, and it is.
I do believe you're right. Oh, Peter, how absurd.
Come on, this calls for a closer inspection.
It is one of ours, Peter.
Another of the crimes perpetrated upon our noble house by the late unlamented Noakes. I will have my pot back, even if I die for it. We will track down our bartered chimneys from end to end of the country, as the Roman legions sought the lost eagles of Varus. I think the luck went out of our house with the chimney pots. It's our job to bring it back.
That'll be fun. I counted this morning. There are only four of them missing. This looks exactly like the three that are left.
I'm positive it's ours. This, Harriet, is an occasion. Let us occupy this handsome seat and contemplate the landscape. The car's well off the road if anybody wants to get up the lane.
What a beautiful spot.
What do you think about life? I mean, do you find it good on the whole? Worth living?
Yes. I've always felt absolutely certain it was good. If only one could get it straightened out. I've hated almost everything that ever happened to me, but I knew all the time it was just things that were wrong, not everything.
With me, it's always been the other way around. I can enjoy practically everything that comes along while it is happening. Only I have to keep on doing things, because if I once stop, it all seems a lot of rot, and I don't care a damn if I go west tomorrow. At least, that's what I should have said. Now, I don't know.
Things have come straight for me, Peter. I always knew they would if one hung on long enough, waiting for a miracle.
Honestly?
Well, it seems like a miracle to be able to look forward. Well, to see all the minutes in front of one come hopping along with something marvellous in them, instead of just saying, well, that one didn't actually hurt, and the next may be quite bearable if only something beastly doesn't come pouncing out.
As bad as that?
No, not really, because one got used to it, to being everlastingly tightened up to face things, you see. But when one doesn't have to anymore, it's different. I can't tell you what a difference it makes. Oh, damn and blast you, Peter. You know you're making me feel exactly like heaven, so what's the use of trying to spare your feelings?
I don't know it, and I can't believe it. But I'll try. Listen, my dear, if that is true, or even half true, I shall begin to be afraid of death, which at my age is rather disturbing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right, you needn't apologize. I like new sensations, especially this one.
17 shillings a bottle.
Do try to keep your voice down, Frank. Mr. Bunter's only down the corridor. He'll hear you.
I don't care if he does, Aggie Twitterton. 17 shillings for a bottle of port. Cut above you and me, and it. 17 bob a bleeding bottle? There's a man could give away £40 of his own pocket and never miss it. But does he? No.
Oh, Frank, you mustn't be so bitter. You couldn't expect Lord Peter
Lord Peter. Oh, you'd be calling him by his pet name. Think he's somebody, didn't you?
That is the correct way to speak of him. I know quite well how to address people of rank.
Oh, yes, I dare say. Suppose you think you've been lowering yourself by associating with me. All right, you're going to hobnob with the gentry, Lord Peter.
Why, Frank, you silly old thing. I believe you're jealous.
Jealous? That's good. That's rich, that is. What's the idea? Starting to make eyes at his lordship now?
Frank! He's a married man. How can you say such things?
Oh, he's married all right. Quite a romance and high life. Like to be in her shoes, wouldn't you?
You don't really think I'd want to change places with anybody, do you? Oh, Frank, if only you and I could get married at once.
Ah, yes, your Uncle Noakes has put a bit of a spoke in that wheel, hasn't he?
I've been trying all day to see you and talk over what we're going to do.
What we're
going to
do? Hadn't been for your soft soap, I'd have got my £40 out of that old devil months ago.
Oh, please, don't be so angry with me. We couldn't either of us know.
It's time we got down to brass tacks. You and me getting spliced with the idea of coming into your uncle's money, that was one thing, see? That's business. But if there's no money from you, it's off. You get that?
Oh, Frank.
A man that's starting in life wants a wife, see? A nice little bit to come home to. Someone he can cuddle. Not a skinny old hen with a brood of buff Orpingtons.
How can you speak to me like that?
Look at yourself in the glass, you old fool. Talk about a man marrying his grandmother.
Oh,
I only wanted to help you get on.
Yeah, I thought you bought me with your uncle's money, didn't you? Well, where is it?
How can you be so cruel? You told me over and over again you were fond of me. You said you were. You said you were.
Oh, can that row.
But you did say so. Oh, you can't. You can't be so cruel. Oh, dear, dear Frank. Oh, don't be kind to me, Frank. I love you so much.
Damn you, get off. Take your blasted claws out of my neck. Shut up.
Oh,
shut up, I tell you. I'm sick and tired of the sight of you.
Oh, God. Ruth. God. Ruth, would you believe it?
Oh, whatever's happening.
Something's up with that bumsucker Bunter.
That lousy old nosy parking bitch, the interfering old bizzard. Where is she?
Where's who?
Mrs. Ruddle, of course. Who told her to go poking her long nose into my pantry?
What's all the fuss about? What are you wanting Mrs. Ruddle for?
I am wanting Mrs. Ruddle because Mrs. Ruddle has done something dreadful to his lordship's port wine.
In that episode of Busman's Honeymoon, the cast was as follows. Lord Peter Wimsey, Ian Carmichael. Lady Peter Wimsey, Sarah Bedell. Bunter, Peter Jones. Miss Twitterton, Rosemary Leach. Mrs. Ruddle, Pearl Hackney. Frank Crutchley, Kenneth Cranham. Salcombe Hardy, Patrick Newell. Sid, David Peart. Narrator, John Westbrook. Busman's Honeymoon was adapted by Alistair Beaton from the book by Dorothy L. Sayers and was produced by Martin Fisher.